Welcome to the Feisty Women's Performance Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Gross, Ironman champion, PhD in women's history, and founder and CEO of Feisty Media. I started this show because I wanted to cut through the BS of diet culture and fitness culture and actually learn from high-achieving women at the top of their game who have figured out how to feel and perform their best at every stage of life. So I chat with experts, elite athletes, and leaders who have learned to succeed despite the massive gender data gap in exercise and medical science and product development. Every episode is filled with information, advice, and anecdotes that will help you fulfill your potential as an athlete, mom, leader, or business owner. And listen up. If you don't subscribe to our Women's Performance newsletter, you are definitely missing out. It's totally free. So head over to womensperformance.com and subscribe now. That's womensperformance.com. This podcast is a production of Feisty Media. Hello, Feisties. Thank you for listening to the Women's Performance Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Gross, and I am so glad you're here today. I have a little something different for you that I know you will enjoy. You will also likely be outraged and possibly even relieved to finally have an explanation for why, in 2024, women's health is lagging so far behind in both research and practice. For those of you who don't know, we have a bunch of podcasts under the Feisty Media umbrella, the most popular of which is Hit Play Not Pause, hosted by Celine Yeager. When I listened to this week's episode of Hit Play Not Pause with Dr. Elizabeth Coleman, I wanted to share it with you all as well. As you listen, I'm sure you'll understand why. Celine's interview with Dr. Coleman is truly eye-opening for women of all ages. And all humans, frankly. As someone with a PhD in women's history, I value a historical perspective on any issue, in particular when it helps make sense of our present situation, our lives, and our overall health as women. That is why I want to share this episode with you today. And if you aren't familiar with Hit Play Not Pause, make sure you subscribe to Celine's podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. We also just launched a new newsletter called Feisty 40 Plus, which is all about maximizing our health and performance as we age. So make sure you subscribe to that over at feistymenopause.com. We also have our strong course on sale right now until April 10th. This is our foundational strength course for women. It's designed to give you everything you need to build a solid foundation for a lifetime of being strong. The course includes a 16-week strength program, but also 7 educational modules on mobility, nutrition, equipment info, everything you need to go from wherever you are right now to lifting heavy. And last thing for me before I hand the mic over to Celine, we have a new sponsor this week on the podcast, Lagoon Sleep. Lagoon makes custom performance pillows. All you have to do is take their quiz online and they'll match you with a pillow suited to your needs. Mine combined maximum height with a little cooling effect, and boom, my sleep is improved. So thank you, Lagoon, for supporting the podcast and our sleep health. So all the links for everything I just mentioned will be in the show notes. I very much hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did.
Are listening to Hit Play, Not Pause, a Feisty Menopause podcast for active, performance-minded women. I am your host, Celine Yeager. Each week, I bring you advice from athletes, scientists, researchers, and other experts to help you feel and perform your best, no matter what your hormones are doing. This show is a production of Live Feisty Media. Hello, strong, feisty women. So, before we start this week, I'd like to take a moment. And if you're not driving, I would like all of you to close your eyes and take a deep breath. inhaling slowly through your nose, and then forcefully exhaling out of your mouth. And then repeat that a few times, inhaling and exhaling until you feel calm and relaxed. Okay, are you calm and relaxed? Good. Because I have a conversation this week that is going to send your blood pressure to the moon. If you've ever wondered why the medical system has been so incredibly off the back when it comes to women's health issues like women's heart disease, menopause, autoimmune disorders, hell, you name it, it's because the origins of Western medicine as we know it was created and perpetuated by men during an astonishingly sexist and misogynistic time. And those roots permeate the system to this day and have real staying power. And man, I knew a lot of that, but there was a ton I did not know until I read this week's guest's new book, All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. It's written by the amazing Dr. Elizabeth Comen, who has dedicated her medical career to saving the lives of women. Comen is an award-winning, internationally sought-after clinician and physician scientist who works as a medical oncologist with a specialty in breast cancer at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and she is also an assistant professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College. And she went deep into the history of her field and has written a really important, infuriating, and honestly wildly entertaining, if head-exploding, book. I could have talked to her for hours, and we did end up talking for the better part of one, so I'll keep this short up front and let the interview speak for itself, but buckle up, this one is a doozy. All right, before we get to it, give us a follow at Feisty Menopause on Instagram and Facebook. Come join our private Hit Play Not Pause Facebook group where we have about 30,000 women chatting all the time, all things menopause. If you want more one-on-one time with experts like we have on this show, come join my Level Up membership, which you can learn about at feistymenopause.com. While you are there, check out our new newsletter. We'll put a link to it in the show notes so you can get it in your inbox each and every week. We are very excited about it. I think you're going to love it. Okay, enough of me. Let's have a few words about our awesome sponsors and get on with the show.
Building muscle can be tough and gains can be so slow, even for those of us who do a lot of strength training. As an ex-endurance athlete who is now in perimenopause, I know this all too well. It can be frustrating to put in the time in the gym and not see the results I'm looking for. That's why it's super important to take the right supplements at the right time. One of those supplements is essential amino acids, which are needed to trigger muscle protein synthesis. Muscle protein synthesis happens when you eat high-quality protein, like eggs or whey. And by supplementing with additional essential amino acids, you can make sure you are getting the full benefit of your training sessions. Targeted essential amino acid formulas can be up to 4 times more effective than just eating protein. I've been taking amino acids for almost a year, and in combination with eating quality protein and a couple other supplements, I have managed to turn the tides on age-related muscle loss, which starts at 30 for women, by the way, and I have continued to make strength gains as I head towards 50. AminoCo has been a longtime sponsor of Feisty Media and has supported all of our brands and podcasts over the years. I recommend starting with AminoCo Perform, and you can grab some at aminoco.com/performance. If you enter the code PERFORMANCE, you will save 30% and receive a free gift if it is your first purchase. Give it a try and let me know how it goes. That's aminoco.com/performance and use the code PERFORMANCE to save 30%.
Hey
As we head into summer, rest and recovery are critical for improving sports performance, reducing stress, and living a long and healthy life. We should all invest in better sleep. So, think about the thing you lay your head on for 8 hours a night. If it's not exactly right for you, it can lead to needless tossing and turning, or worse, have you waking up with an unrelenting kink in your neck. My new Lagoon pillow has helped me improve my sleep immensely by pairing me with the performance pillow that has everything I need. So I personally was matched with the Otter pillow. Shout out to Team Otter, which I love because it has a gentle cooling effect. And I was able to choose how much stuffing I wanted in it, which is super important to me because I'm doing a decent amount of CrossFit these days and my shoulders are kind of creaky. So having a pillow that is stuffed just to the right height keeps my neck and head in exactly the right position and comfortable for the entire night. And as of fall 2023, Lagoon launched their 100% mulberry silk pillowcases. It's cool to the touch, buttery soft, and great for your skin and hair. You've got to go check out this pillowcase if you want to feel great and look great every morning. Waking up for morning workouts has never felt better. I'm refreshed and pain-free thanks to my Lagoon pillow. To check it out for yourself, go to lagoonsleep.com/performance and take the 2-minute sleep quiz to find your perfect pillow match. And then use the code PERFORMANCE for 15% off your first purchase. That's code PERFORMANCE at lagoonsleep.com/performance, whole 15% off, and the link is in the show notes. You can just click through there.
Okay, Elizabeth, I am so glad that Amy connected us. She's connected me some of the greatest people. I'm so grateful for her. And I loved your book. Do you have a copy of it that you can hold up?
Ta-da!
All in her head, because my God, how many times are we dismissed? It's all in your head. We're hysterical women. Anyway, it reminded me of Unwell Women by historian Eleanor Cleghorn. I don't know if you read her book. I had her on very early on and I really enjoyed her as well. But just when you don't think you can get more dumbfounded, you turn the page of your, What inspired you specifically, you to write this book? Like, tell us a bit about your background and how you came to write this book.
Sure. So first of all, thank you so much for having me on. It's truly an honor. So as you know, I'm an oncologist specializing in breast cancer. So my whole career has really been dedicated to taking care of women, thousands of women at this point. And while there are some men that get breast cancer, it's, as we know, a predominantly female disease. I also majored in the history of medicine and have had this longstanding passion in really understanding the context and the experience of illness. Two women can have the same exact diagnosis of breast cancer, but we know that biology doesn't define illness. Experience with it and how we feel in our bodies does. And in the course of my career and taking care of thousands of women, I think it just became this overwhelming tsunami of trying to unpack the shame women presented with, the amount of times they've been dismissed, invalidated for their symptoms. I've been a patient myself as I've gotten older and become a mother as well. And I developed almost this rage, to be quite honest, and I shouldn't apologize for that. But why are we here? Why are so many women being held back in their health? Why are we not doing better? And I felt really mission driven to help try to move the needle in improving women's health.
Thank you so much for that. I mean, it is really important. And there's no way, I mean, as I read it, I wanted to cover everything. I literally wanted to cover everything, but we can't cover everything. This is a podcast. So I encourage folks very much to get this book and read it because it really does. One of the things that we joke about on the show sometimes is that I should rebrand it. Why didn't I know this? like every time I have a guest on, they're like, why didn't I know this about perimenopause? Why didn't I know this about menopause? Why didn't I know this? And your book does such a great job of sort of explaining like why we are so far behind in our knowledge of all of it.
Yes.
So let's start with the fact that women were not allowed in the medical field from its inception. Can you talk a bit about the history of women in medicine? Maybe going back to being murdered for being witches, you know, to being barred from medical school. Just take us back a little bit to set the stage.
Well, to set the stage, you know, there's a long history of generational knowledge, ancestral knowledge of women caring for women, whether it's midwives or women being the primary caregivers of their family and having agency in their home. To skip over some history, certainly during the Middle Ages, and as faith became more important to society, particularly in Europe, the idea that faith-based medicine was where it was at, as opposed to some of the other healing techniques that women might have been engaged in. As you know, from the Malleus Maleficarum, which was a doctrine that the church put out, there was so much in there that women were basically, women healers were the source of all ills. And of course, our clitoris was the devil's tit. So, you know, we got to check every woman for that. And women were disproportionately killed because in many capacities because of their healing powers and healing techniques. And when we fast forward through at the turn of the 19th century, you know, at that time, doctors and physicians as a profession was not as extolled as it is today. And certainly medical schools were not as codified in terms of the rigorous studying that needed to go in and certifications that needed to go into becoming a doctor. But when medical schools became more rigorous, and there was a rise of medical schools, women were not allowed entry into them. So, for example, many of the midwives that were accustomed to taking care of women did not learn germ theory because they didn't have access to this schooling for it. They just had generational knowledge, ancestral knowledge. And when we had this rise of medical specialization, rise of the field of medical schools, women were functionally sidelined, both as patients, but even more so as practitioners. Now, we have some great doctors that did make it through medical school, few and far between, like Elizabeth Blackwell, but certainly women were not, for the most part, allowed entry into medical school. So you had this field entirely of medicine, including gynecology, which was men practicing on women. And in turn, women's voices as healers were lost and pushed out of medicine as we know it today.
And we know how that looked like in the early days of gynecology. What do the numbers look like today? You cited some really interesting findings on the surgical outcomes of women operated on men versus women operated on by women, which I thought was really interesting.
Yes. So a few points to make, which is that we, certainly in my med school class, it was greater than 50% women. And when I wrote this book, I really, yes, we're talking about the men that built the systems of the past, but this isn't about men versus women. And it's about what is the feminine spirit of healing that's been squeezed out of medicine? And how do we make sure that concepts that we traditionally align with women, such as empathy and nurturing, are also valued and are also admired in medicine, such that we can nurture these qualities in both male and female healers? And when we look, for example, at a lot of the data about women as physicians and other providers, we know that women historically and to this day listen longer, have better outcomes for their patients. There was a recent surgical study that showed that if you are a woman being operated on a man, you are more likely to have a worse outcome than if you're operated on by a woman. But if you're a man or a woman operated on by a woman, your outcomes are the same. And that's just unacceptable, right? There's something that's missing in the story there. Your outcome should be good, whether you're operated on a male by a male physician or a female physician. And we know there are so many women that say, I prefer female providers. And I think the key is not to say, well, all doctors should just be women then. No, it should be, what are women doing better? And how do we value that in medicine? If our goal is to just say, well, we should increase the numbers of women, but we're not actually putting them in leadership positions and honoring them for what they are good at, we don't need more women pretending to be a male model of care. We need more diversity of all spirits in our healthcare system.
I couldn't have, yeah, that's a great way to explain that. Thank you. One of the things that struck me, speaking of this sort of early male-dominated medical field that went on for, I don't know, thousands of years, many years.
Yes.
They are insanely obsessed with female masturbation beyond any, like, I can't even, like, as I was reading through your book, I was like, what is happening? Like, from riding bikes to, like, looking at their labia to see if they're, like, promiscuous because if they're large, maybe they masturbate too much. I couldn't wrap my head around it. Can you talk a little bit about like how this permeates everywhere and why?
I have to tell you, I did not expect to find that in my research. So for example, for the bones chapter and trying to really unpack what's the history of the female skeleton and our understanding of that. And obviously scoliosis predominantly affects women. And I really wanted to understand the history of scoliosis. Why am I reading about famous doctors saying that masturbation causes laziness and scoliosis? Why is masturbation being mentioned again? I mean, you can imagine how many times I just kind of threw down the book and screamed like, really? What? And it causes asthma? Really? Okay. And what's fascinating to me is how much women's sexual desire, the fear of it, the attempt to control it, weaves and permeates through every aspect of the history of women's health and what doctors said about women, whether sex was a cure for hysteria or a cause of hysteria, whether you should make sure to have sex for curing whatever problem that you had, but only with your husband and only when he desires you, not if you desire him too much. It is absolutely mind-boggling to me. So you and me both. And I think the reason why this history is so important is because this intense focus, whether it was masturbation or libido, whatever it may be, still permeates our care today. And almost in a more insidious, subtle, less egregious way where you're like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. But if you think about in my practice, for example, in breast cancer patients, we are so far behind in addressing their sexual health needs, their libido concerns, their sexual wellness concerns, which are very real and important to many women for how they find joy and thrive both during and after a cancer diagnosis. We know that, for example, with cancer patients, we are 2 times more likely to ask men about sexual side effects than women about sexual side effects. It's as if it doesn't matter. And that, of course, we know is not true. And so I think this history is very important for understanding the subtlety of where we are today and why that subtlety still plays out in actually quite egregious ways in our care of women today.
Well, and look at the massive investment in Viagra and all of those drugs versus crickets for so long for women, you know, sexual, like low libido, especially around menopause. We hear it all the time. Like we can't even, there's no FDA approved testosterone product for women, even though there's some studies that show that it can help.
Right. And we know that, you know, over 40% of women have some sexual health care concern, and they may not feel comfortable talking to their doctor about it because we don't create that space. We don't create that time. We don't normalize that women have sexual health care needs. And it's a damn shame.
Yeah. And some of that, I mean, quite frankly, felt like a lot of projection to me, like the whole masturbation thing. I'm like, what are you guys really talking about here? You know? I mean,
right.
You know?
Right. I mean, one of the most striking things is at Countway Library, which is the history of medicine library at Harvard, there was a Dr. Dickinson who promoted tampons because, you know, they were better than pads, because if you wore pads, you were going to have too much erotic friction from the pad. Anyway,
said every woman ever, like all of us, right?
Yes, yes, of course. But he had these models of women's vulvas where he would presumably, and good Lord, how are these models taken, you know? But he had these models where you could apparently tell who was a masturbator, who was a lesbian, who was a virgin, who was not, as if you could look at a woman and determine that.
Oh my God.
And we don't know who are these women that modeled for him, how he examined them, but it was just sort of horrific trying to even imagine it. And then being labeled as such.
You're making my jaw drop even more than even when I was reading it. I would love you to talk a bit, speaking of the whole bicycle thing, you know, just because our audience, a lot of cyclists in the house. I have a long history with the sport. Just how I was struck that even into the 60s, the language around like women on bicycles was so toxic.
So toxic. So at the turn of the century, when bicycles became really in favor and an exciting new mode of exercise, it also became something that was a symbol of the suffragist movement because it gave women mobility from their home. They didn't need a horse and buggy. They didn't need anyone to take them on this bike. They could go far on their own. And we know for all of us who love to cycle, there's just such freedom and joy of an open road. But doctors were certainly also arbiters, moral arbiters of what women could and could not do, whether how they exercised and also what they could wear. And one of the things that came out in many of the medical journals was, well, you might get bicycle face, this horrible condition from riding a bike. Your face would be frozen in a grimace and you would develop these massive, bulky, grotesque muscles. But the worst of it all was that, you know, you might masturbate on the bike while you're riding. You could, someone once said to me, ride it till the wheels fall off. And I just think, well, I would too, if that's what a bike did for me, right? Like God
we would
you.
All be out there all day.
I just wouldn't get off it. But yes, so this was the concern, or that it was going to disturb our reproductive organs so much and lead to lunacy. That was another reason why, because of course our mission on this earth is, well, from puberty to reproductive age, that our reproductive fitness is everything. And if we don't protect that, then what are we good for? So it's really just shocking to me. I mean, time and again, I had these reactions of just reading, was this really published in a medical journal? There was even, so Dr. Dickinson, our vulva model master over there, also said he didn't have any cases of women masturbating on the bike, but of course this was still a serious concern. So women needed to be monitored. And many of the newspapers came out actually saying what you could and could not do for women on a bike. So what you could wear, what you could look like, how you should behave, how you shouldn't be intimidating, how you shouldn't try too hard. Really just terrific. And again, these are dramatic examples, but then where are we with women's medicine today or exercise today? You know better than anybody else. We have so far to go in really how we guide women about how they can use their bodies to feel strong and coach them therein.
Yeah. And there's also this idea that permeates the book of women's bodies being mysterious and unknowable and sometimes like dirty, you know, especially when it comes to periods, like that just permeates it. We have wandering wombs and all of that. Can you talk a bit about how that impacts us to this day? Because there's still this cultural idea like that women should eat differently than men and we should, you know, our womb takes so much space and that we're still like so misunderstood. It's insane.
We're misunderstood and we need to behave, you know, including historically when we go to the doctor's office as well. That was not in every space a safe space for us to really be cared for. So I think what you're really touching upon is this at times very obvious, but other times really insidious incuriosity about what was really going on with women, hence the title, All in Her Head. When you look, for example, at autoimmune diseases, they are 80% more likely in women, but we do not consider that an autoimmune, a woman's health concern, for example, right? I mean, I didn't even know that 80% of autoimmune diseases were in women. And I say this because some of the symptoms of fatigue or joint pain or aches that are hard to describe because we don't have the lexicon because we haven't been listening to women enough is part of the reason why we are so far behind because they weren't happening to men. And so when you have men interviewing and speaking to women, they're deciding the language, they're deciding the pain scales. Things like irritable bowel syndrome also more common in women than men. And one of the biggest issues in really trying to advance that field is if you have male doctors who don't have the same experience with the disease, trying to then impose onto women what they may be feeling, as opposed to saying, describe your symptoms to me. Let's talk about what does that bloating look like, feel like? What does that pain look like, feel like? If we don't have the language and the lexicon, then we can't advance these fields and truly come up with pain scales or symptom scales that we can actually work with in clinical trials and also when we meet patients in clinic. It just becomes this amalgam of, oh, you're tired and you're uncomfortable and you're bloated, whether it's an autoimmune disease or a GI disease, that when you have diseases that are more in women than in men, it changes the dynamic in that doctor-patient relationship historically.
Yeah, and we are still seeing that. And somehow our pain is dismissed, yet all in our head, yet we give birth, you know, yet like we go through a lot of things that are really very painful.
Right.
We know what pain is.
we know what pain is, or people just say, oh, women can tolerate pain better. Well, what does that mean? Should we?
Right.
Could we? Why are we enduring suffering?
Right. Right. Very high tolerance for women's suffering. Dr. Rebecca Thurston was, I have on the show next week, was just talking about that. My mind was really blown about the discussion of women's colons being longer. Like, that seemed like a real, a very tangible impact of everything that you're saying still affecting us today. Can you talk a bit about that, Guy?
Sure. So I had interviewed this woman, Dr. Susan Lusick, who predominantly takes care of women with irritable bowel syndrome. And she was talking to me a lot about, and this we also don't have the language for, about women's history of constipation and the assumption that this is something that women suffer from more, and they do on the most part. But also, I mean, not to be too grotesque or gross, but you know, men are allowed to kind of, we have this vision of men just sort of like hang in the bathroom for as long as they want. And women have to get in and get out because there's going to be a kid coming for them, or they got something to do, or they're afraid to go to the bathroom at work. They got to go to another floor. There was an interesting article in the New York Times called the poop triarchy. Like, instead of patriarchy, the poop triarchy, that you have these, you know, women CEOs rushing to find some other private bathroom because they don't feel comfortable going in a public bathroom. Where in the world did this happen that men somehow get to experience whatever luxury the bathroom, but women don't have the time? The problem is constipation begets constipation, and your colon can actually potentially, we don't know, but her hypothesis and others is that it can actually become longer and more torturous. And we also, torturous meaning, you know, circular or winding. You also have obviously reproductive organs that make it a little bit more complicated anatomically. But one of the interesting things that she told me was that colonoscopies on average take longer for women, because of the nature of the winding colon, because some of these women may be suffering over time for more constipation, have a longer colon. And so it takes more careful time to do the colonoscopy. Well, more women tend to want a female gastroenterologist doing their colonoscopy, right? If each colonoscopy takes a little bit longer, or they have to take more time with that patient, then they bill less over time, right? And men can churn out more patients because they're seeing more. So think about this in an academic setting or any setting. The men will have a higher volume, and the female physicians, if they are seeing more women, will have a lower volume and be seen as less productive. This is something that also we see across the board, that women physicians are often the mom consults, whether they're mothers or not. They will be expected to take more time with patients. They will be expected to do better with the quote unquote difficult patient because they're going to listen longer and have more empathy. But then you can imagine how this kind of snowballs. If to be promoted in academic medicine or seen as productive is to see more patients, but you're spending longer with patients, that's harder to do. Or if productivity is also seen as a function of some gene that you discover rather than patient care, we're having a harder time elevating women in leadership positions because they may be spending more time with patients and not seen as productive.
So much work today.
So the long-winded answer from winding colons to how we rise in the ladder of academia.
No, that's,
but
that's
it's all related.
It is all related. And that's what this book is about and why I loved it so much. And I would love to pivot to hormones. And I'll be completely honest. When I read, when you started talking about Dr. Robert Wilson, I literally said out loud, oh, here we go with this fucking guy. That's all I could think, because I was just like, what is fascinating to me is the quote that made, you know, always makes me roll my eyes, has been held up. And that quote is, the unpalatable truth must be faced that all postmenopausal women are castrates. And what's fascinating to me is that quote is being held up, like vaulted today by some prominent doctors in the menopause space, is like he was ahead of his time. In some ways he was, but also so problematic in other ways. And can you talk about that dichotomy here? I think that story is actually really emblematic of a lot of what this book presents.
Yes. So I love that you dropped the F-bomb, because I had the same feeling. of course, because is this the best it effing gets? Right. So we're extolling somebody who, yes, took an interest in menopausal women, but this is as good as it gets. I mean, the story that he talks about, one of the stories that's in the chapter about the guy from the mafia who is sick himself, had a menopausal wife, wanted to make sure that she was going to be healthy enough to care for him and his illness, brings a gun to his office, Wilson's office, and says, "You got to fix my wife or I'm going to kill her." I mean, this is the story that you're putting in a book about helping women? That's as good as it gets. And so you can trace the history of hormone replacement therapy and see just how much we have ping-ponged women from this guy was really our champion and basically said we were cows to you can't give hormone replacement therapy to anybody because you're going to all get breast cancer, which is how I was trained, to now where we still don't know, can we give testosterone? Can we not give testosterone? How much hormonal replacement therapy? What if you have a history of breast cancer? And certainly, and tragically, in my patients, only recently were we able to really demonstrate in large-scale studies that you can use intravaginal estrogen, even in breast cancer patients. This does not worsen their outcomes. That is huge for these women that really are suffering from debilitating discomfort day to day. That's unacceptable.
It is unacceptable. And we have so much work to catch up now. I mean, because now you have, I mean, that's why we're here, but that's, you have this generation of women who came up with Title IX, you know, they're active, they're in, they entered the workplace en masse, you know, in the 60s, in the 70s. They're now in this space, they're in positions of power, they're demanding care and answers, and everyone's like, huh? You know, like there's just like this shrug because we're so far behind.
We're so far behind. And the problem is, sometimes in order to prove safety, particularly, for example, in breast cancer patients, you need a lot of women as part of a clinical trial. And it wasn't even until 1993 that NIH studies were mandating that women be included in clinical trials. So when we're talking about long-term outcomes for patients, where we're trying to say, does this improve things like dementia or heart disease? And yes, you have a lot of people doing incredible work, but we are still far behind in asking some of the critical questions that we need to. Certainly in my field of breast cancer.
100%. And women, you know, I put myself in that category. I mean, we are in the position of just having to make decisions with what we have, right? Because it could be another 10 or 20 years. And in that point, some of us won't be here. Some of us will be way past the point, you know? So it's,
yes,
we're just in this position of being like, okay, well, I just have to take this information. And people wonder why women are so vulnerable to influencer marketing and people who tell them. Well, it's true though. Like when somebody then comes to you and says, "I am here, I have the answers," this like and speaks very definitively, I am very sympathetic to why women are just eager to hear that messaging.
Oh my gosh. I'm so glad you brought that up, because if you look at the supplement industry, the tens of billions of dollars that go into that, we know that women are the primary consumers of that, both for themselves and for their family. And when you look at the overall wellness industry and this wellness that we're all chasing, of course we're chasing it, and we have, you know, Google and our own agency, and we're smart. But the problem is we've been shut out from so many key parts of our medical care and the traditional medical system, that it's understandable that women seek these other things that may actually be snake oil, but we do it because no one's given us a better option. And you see that throughout history, that whether it was some of the crazy advertisements for constipation, well, you know, take this salt and you're going to be beautiful again, right? Because constipation is so horrible, but this salt will make you look better. But also some more really remarkable studies that'll say, or advertisements, your doctor isn't listening to you, but I can. Your doctor hasn't really heard you, but I will. And this is what you need. And you see that throughout history, particularly to today. We know you're uncomfortable. We know you're in pain. We know you've been dismissed. I've got something better. And let me charge you for it. What's where I really see this, and it's has deadly consequences, is in the cancer space. Right? When people don't feel heard, when they don't feel understood, when they distrust the medical care system, they may mortgage their home, sell all their life possessions because someone has told them, I have the answer for you. And that's the extreme of all of it, but we see it all the time.
Yeah. And that, thank you for sharing that. I bet you do, because people are, if people are desperate in menopause, they're desperate times 100 in your field and oncology, mm-hmm. right? Like it's so different. And, you know, in menopause, like, it has not been traditionally taught in schools. Like still, like up until like 2019, there was still a paltry amount of residents that were getting any menopause classes.
I had none. I don't have any recollection, period, no pun intended, of any other than like it happens and don't give hormone replacement therapy because everyone's going to get breast cancer.
Jesus. Yep. Yeah. So it's yes, that sets the stage for everything that we're seeing, you know, and everything that women are experiencing. Speaking of, we need to talk, also permeates the book, this notion of women who are frail as being beautiful. And I read it so many times it comes up, you know, within your book. And, you know, when I read this, and I'll just read this little excerpt, all I could think of was the heroin chic of the 90s. When you're talking about, with obvious exceptions, again, the diarrhea, the look of tuberculosis did tend to align with beauty standards of the time. Skin so pale it became transparent. Emaciation brought on by lack of appetite. A natural blush in the cheeks and lips. My God. That's all I could think of is we made heroin addiction sexy too. Like it never ends.
Yes. 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 Well, the frail woman isn't a strong woman. And I think there is a undercurrent in society of what happens if women are strong, right? Whether it's through exercise, we should be small and thin and dainty, whether it's how we eat or cycle or ride. And we don't really need to lift heavy weights because why would we do that? We have men who can lift heavy things.
Yeah. And that does lead to the fear of muscles and being quote unquote bulky, which is a word I wish I could just crumple up and throw into an incinerator. But I literally, Elizabeth, just spoke to a 50-year-old woman who was telling me, you know, she's kind of nervous about menopause. Her mom is just 75, fell and broke her arm and has osteoporosis. Mm. So she knows she needs to lift. And we had this whole conversation. And then she's like, but what do you do? What am I supposed to do? I want to be lean. I don't want to get big muscles. And I was just I couldn't even speak for a couple seconds. I was like,
yeah, I was just looking up this Pilates class, on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I was at this new studio just opened and I opened up the frequently asked questions because I was curious about I don't know whether they had showers there or something. and one of the questions was the question and the answer is, will I get bulky muscles from this? Why are we, and it's the same word over and over again. Are you going to get bulky thighs from your spin class? Are you going to get bulky from, why are we even putting this into the lexicon of what women are worried about? It's really terrifying. But where I really see this day in and day out is patience, because we don't have a history of teaching women how to actually strength train. I have been a dancer my whole life. I've been a worker outer my whole life. I think I've tried every fitness craze ever, from pole dancing to spin to circus class, you name it, I have done it. But I realized only in recent years that I don't know how to properly lift weights at all. And that takes a lot of years of proper training to learn how to not hurt yourself, to advance to heavier weights, to all sorts of kettlebells. I mean, there are so many cool things that women can learn that are tons of fun, but were never part of anything, despite my massive gym experience and exercise experience that I didn't know. So then when I meet patients who really have only run or maybe, you know, done the elliptical, they have no idea. So if we're just telling them, oh, you need to strength train and then leave it at that, when most doctors have zero training in exercise physiology or nutrition and protein intake, we're leaving all these women behind to say, oh, go walk into that intimidating gym and maybe use some equipment and maybe do some bicep curls. We haven't built into our education system for how to do that at all.
Yeah, 100%.
And it took me a long time working with someone to figure out how to do that and how to do that for my own body.
I mean, that's where I think CrossFit has done, you know, as problematic as it has been in some areas, I think it has done light years of good in many ways for women in celelebrating women who take up space, helping them be strong, helping them be, you know, and it's when you walk into one of those places, you're like, oh, it's different here.
Yeah. Yeah. But CrossFit, and I agree with you. I think that's fantastic. And also not everybody can do CrossFit. So how do we integrate into our society things that women can do and not just say, oh, go for a walk. That's weight bearing exercise. Go for 30 minutes, 5 times a week, and then just leave people with no guidance.
Well, and I have to say a lot of this medical, a lot of our obsession with thinness obviously comes from the medical obsession with thinness. And when you're talking about muscles, you can't talk about all of it without talking about BMI. You know, so it's damaging women, whether they have a quote unquote healthy BMI or not. You know, I mean, when everything is on this very flawed metric.
Totally flawed metric that was never built for its use today. You can't just look at someone's height and weight and determine their fitness. Obviously, we have an absolute epidemic of obesity in this country. And so you can have some metric if someone is morbidly obese, right? But the metrics of fitness and what's healthy are far more subtle and far more nuanced than BMI, which doesn't account for so many things. My colleague, Dr. Neil Iyengar at MSK, has done a lot of work looking at BMI. But one of the other things that he showed was that, you know, this concept of skinny fat, that you could have a normal BMI, but really have very limited muscle mass, barely be able to lift 15-pound groceries, and you may have the same risk of breast cancer as a result of your fat to muscle ratio and metabolic function as someone who's far heavier than you. And so we are looking at some women and saying in the doctor's office, oh, your weight to your height is great. You're in good shape. You are not in good shape, right? You are at risk for falls. Your metabolic health is terrible. And we don't have the tools to really measure that or talk to women about that effectively, about how to improve.
And the same goes. I mean, if you look at the research on, you know, that there's the same thick thighs save lives, like women with lower body fat. And, you know, it's, they don't have, even if they have more fat, they're not at the same risk. It depends where that fat is. Is it active? What's their muscle? We don't account for any of that in women.
No. And we certainly don't, when it comes to building muscle, we don't really talk about nutrition in a thoughtful way, right? So we can say, eat a plant heavy diet, but how do you, and avoid processed meats and red meats and all of that. But how do you make sure that women are getting adequate protein intake, particularly as they get older, particularly if they're then going to try to increase their strength training? This is something I also didn't know about. You know, I am also one of those people where, you know, I eat predominantly plants and I'm into salads and all of that, but where am I getting my protein from? This is only something that in writing this book and really taking more interest in exercise physiology that I have learned I know not enough about. And yet I'm in a position to be talking to women about how they can live healthy lives. And if this is what I'm passionate about, what's happened in the rest of our healthcare system?
A lot is happening. We're very good at fixing things when they're broken, but not so good at keeping them from becoming broken.
Exactly. And that, it's a very interesting point that you say that, because if you look at the specialties that women are predominantly in, they are often in those fields where there's continuity of care, where it isn't necessarily a surgical subspecialty. Urology is very limited in the number of women. Orthopedic surgery, right, which is a quick in and out fix it type of field. But other types of fields like oncology or palliative care or pediatrics or primary care, these are a lot of the fields, psychiatry, that women have taken up space and require longer term relationships with patients. But these are also ones that are less likely to be funded for, less likely to be remunerated. And we value in our medical care system those doctors that can go in and fix it quickly, as opposed to those that are here for the process and experience of illness, no matter the outcome. And sometimes that's being present for suffering and easing suffering, which we do not value as a society as being important in our healthcare system.
As a lifelong runner and triathlete turned CrossFitter, I am stoked to announce that the athletic eyewear brand Tifosi Optics has joined us as a partner here at Feisty Media. Tifosi sports glasses hit all the marks for athletes. They're shatterproof polybicarbonate, so the lenses not only reduce glare, but also offer scratch resistance, which I 100% need. They stay in place when you are moving. The hydrophilic rubber nose pads actually get more grippy the more you sweat, so they are secure and don't slide down your face even when you're running in hot conditions. No matter what sport you do, Tifosi has shades for you. Whether you love tennis, fishing, pickleball, running, cycling, or just hanging out on the beach. They are super reasonably priced, which I love, so I can have multiple pairs that go with any outfit. And of course, Feisty listeners get a special discount. So, head on over to TifosiOptics.com and use the code FM20. FM as in Feisty Media to get 20% off your order. That's FM20 at TifosiOptics.com. I'll put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you. Endurance sports should be accessible to everyone, right? That's why we are so excited to be partnering with Motive. Motive is one of the fastest growing training apps in the world today, with thousands of amateur athletes signing up every month and a nearly perfect 4.9 star rating in the App Store. You are not a template, and your training plan should not be either. Prepare for running races, triathlons, cycling events, duathlons, or swim runs, however your season schedule shapes up, and get training written by some of the best coaches in the world in each discipline who know what it takes to help amateur athletes reach their goal on race day. The app takes the training written by those experts and then creates the most optimal training plan for your schedule, abilities, and goals. Plus, the training is fully customized to your race schedule. How much you can train each week, your current abilities, and the goals you want to achieve in your race. You can use the app for free as long as you want, or get all the upgraded features from the app for just $19.99 a month. But as a Feisty listener, you can sign up at mymotive.com and use the code FEISTY for 2 months of full premium access. That's right, you get 2 months of premium for free. So you quite literally have nothing to lose. So head over to mymotive.com, mymotive.com, and use the code FEISTY, FEISTY. And on a personal note, I know the founder of Motive, and he is driven to make triathlon and all endurance sports more accessible for the athletes who care about their performance, but who aren't quite ready for a full-time personal coach. If that sounds like you, definitely try the app for 2 months for free. You literally have nothing to lose.
I'd like to pivot again and talk a bit about how we die because we're anxious, nervous creatures. You know, you have stories like it's the all in your head, you know, encapsulated. You know, I will share that my own mother, and I've shared this on the podcast before, but it bears repeating. You know, she was not a healthy woman. She smoked. She's still alive. She smoked for many, many years. She eats nothing but like chocolate and chicken nuggets like a 5-year-old. Does not exercise. I could go on and on. She was having shoulder pain, panic attacks, all the things. And I said, go to your doctor. She went to their doctor and her doctor gave her nerve pills. And she had a massive heart attack a month later.
Oh, my God.
Right. I assumed wrongly that they would have checked that. And she'd had high, like all of the things, like flying red flags. God. She's with us. Yeah. She's fine. She still doesn't take care of herself, but she's got like, you know, her arteries or she had her surgeries. But oh my God.
Yeah. Oh, and first of all, I'm so sorry that happened to your mom. And that story is all too common in different contexts, but the same thread. So really makes me think about how we know that heart disease is the number one killer of women. We are greater than 50% of the population. But historically in medical school, I was taught that women's chest pain was atypical, right? That the way that we present with heart disease is atypical. You go back to William Osler, who was the founding father of our residency whole system. He worked out of Johns Hopkins, really, really famous in the history of medicine. I read his original books on the history of on heart disease and concepts like angina, which refers to chest pain. Every case that a woman was presenting with angina, he referred to that as hysterical angina. And they're actually okay. Women never die from heart disease. This is literally in what he writes. However, he then describes who is the classic person to have heart disease. And this was, you know, over 100 years ago. It's the white-haired, hardworking man whose engines are just going too fast. But this is exactly what you then picture in the movies about who has a heart attack. We don't really weave into our culture and into our medical language, what does it look like for a woman to have a heart attack? We assume that her symptoms are atypical, which is just absolute. They're typical for women. Why isn't that built into the language of what we understand?
And since we're more of the population, they're typical by definition, you know?
Typical by definition. And it's the number one thing that kills women.
Right.
64% of women who have sudden death from cardiac disease didn't have symptoms before then. I mean, there's so much that we don't understand, that we don't train women about, train doctors about. It's not acceptable.
And we didn't, and you bring this up in the book, like, even those studies in the 90s looking at aspirin contained no women. I mean, so much of the research contained no women.
Right, right. And still we're trying to have gender parity in what we understand about women's heart disease. But if you look at how we visualize our vessels, our hearts are different, right? And the way that our circulatory system is slightly different, and we need different imaging perhaps. I spoke to an electrophysiologist, so someone who studies the conductivity of the heart and why and how it beats in certain arrhythmias. I did not know that EKGs change during a woman's menstrual cycle and can change in terms of how we interpret them after menopause. And when women are more likely to have arrhythmias or irregular heartbeats can change based on their menstrual cycle. I had no idea. I look at EKGs all the time in women. No idea. So where is everybody else in all of this? And, you know, there's a lot we need to fix. The EKGs were not built for studying women.
Yeah. I had on, Martha Giulotti
Yes. She's fantastic.
She said the only thing women do better in the cardiac field is die. I mean, that's exactly she's like, they get less preventative care, they get less emergency care, they get less tertiary, like all of it. She's like, the only thing they do better than men in this whole field is die. And, you know, it's an uphill battle.
Yes. Yes. Oh,
yeah.
That really hits home.
That's
a metric I do not want to be good at.
And she brought up such good, you know, she's like, women are very, very busy. They're not coming into your ER because they're nervous. You know, they're not like, they have other things to do. If they're in there, they actually have something wrong with them. Like, believe them.
Believe them. There was a study that showed that women are more likely to call an ambulance for a heart attack in their husband than they are to call the ambulance for themselves.
Yeah, I believe that.
That's the other part of that. In every aspect of our healthcare system, women are the primary providers. They are, meaning for their families as caregivers, right? And so what happens to us when we get sick? What about the fact that women are 2 times more likely than men to have Alzheimer's disease? Who takes care of these aging women? We are really not understanding the nature of dementia and Alzheimer's in women, certainly not addressing concussions, which is something that we can talk about as well. What happens to women in that context? And most importantly, what happens and who takes care of these women when their minds begin to fail them? Is it their daughters? Right. That's what we anticipate. That's what we expect. I once had another physician say to me, I wish I had a daughter like you. I only have sons. And I wish I had a daughter because everybody needs a daughter to take care of them when they get older.
I have no words for that.
It was more than one male physician has said that to me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you do bring up, and I think it's worth touching on concussion, you bring it up in the book with your own mother's case.
Yes.
And I have seen it in my life. I'm actually working on a podcast separately, a series on concussion in women, because of how post-concussion, you know, and it's the same thing, like it's not as well understood as like the menstrual cycle can factor into it.
Of course.
Yeah, feel free to share a little bit about what you found there.
So again, I mean, in writing this book, there are so many aspects of my personal life and obviously women's health at large that just shocked me. And in the course of writing it, my mom had been hit by a bike and was thrown into a garbage can, hit her head. And when we took her to the emergency room, I was so worried. Did she have a bleed in her brain? She had a CAT scan. It didn't show that. She had broken her clavicle and everyone said, no bleed in the brain. Her clavicle's broken, but you know, those heal on her own. Off you go. And I remember thinking, but you know, she hit her head on a garage can, and then she fell and hit the cement. Like, ooh. Shouldn't we be thinking about that? And then we brought her home and I thought she was okay. And very shortly thereafter, it was very clear that she had had significant head trauma. And though she wasn't bleeding in her head, you know, she had had a serious concussion. And to tell you, even with all my resources, I had to beg, plead, basically, you know, offer to sell my entire world just to get into a neurologist to help me with her concussion. And I bounced around from doctor to doctor to doctor to really find the right help that I needed. And again, thought to myself, what does the average woman do who may not have this sort of healthcare advocacy? And then I think one of the most tragic parts of writing this book is my learning that one out of every four women suffers intimate violence, physical violence at the hands of an intimate partner. And that's just what's recorded, right? 25% of women. And some percentage of those women are having serious concussions, multiple head traumas that, you know, when the police come, they may think that the woman is high or on drugs or drunk or can't give a good story, but they may have been hit in the head and not remember it. I mean, how horrible is that? I'm not saying that we shouldn't have better protocols for football players and better helmets and all of that, but what is happening to the real numbers of women that are suffering from concussions in this country, whether it's from falls or head trauma at the hands of another person? That is an epidemic in this country that we are woefully leaving women behind on. And it frankly disgusts me.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. That is, that's heartbreaking on multiple levels.
Yeah. And with the domestic violence and talking to a classmate of mine from med school, who's an emergency room physician, you know, she was teaching me just how often women are strangled. And they may not know that they've necessarily been strangled because they lose consciousness. And you have to have emergency room physicians that can look for those marks effectively and look for that trauma and how that plays out over time. And, you know, if a woman has ever been strangled in her life, that same person is far more likely to murder them in the future. It's almost a gateway process to murder. I didn't have any idea of that. The only thing I learned in medical school was really about asking women, are you safe at home? It shouldn't be when they get to the emergency room that we are really addressing women's physical safety at home.
100%. And that, you know, I've done shows that what you are talking about also leads to a much harder menopause experience. They have earlier symptoms, more symptoms, poorer sleep. You know, it's just a cascading effect, and that sets them up for higher cardiovascular disease risk, higher, you know, it's that has a knock-on effect that goes decades.
Of course, of course. I'm glad you're doing that work.
Yeah, thank you.
For decades, running shoes have been researched, tested, and designed for men. Brands have relied on the shrink it and pink it approach to sell male shoes to female customers. That's why we are so excited to be working with Hedas. Hedas designs athletic footwear for women that elevates performance, safety, and style. Hedas unlocks the science behind women's biomechanics through dedicated research, creates better shoes for women that support their longevity and performance, and establishes new design standards to promote transparency in a male-biased industry. Hedas have a lower ankle collar to reduce rubbing, a breathable mesh toe box to allow for ventilation and to allow for female toe shape, a special kind of plate in the midsole to keep tired legs going, a narrow heel cup to reduce heel slippage and take the pressure off our Achilles, and a rounded instep to create a snug fit. Hedas has three shoe models designed for different sessions: the Alma Cruise for long runs, the Alma Tempo for training days, and the Alma Speed for pushing the pace. I've personally been running in the Alma Cruise and I love them. It's the shoe I always wanted and never knew I needed. The fit is perfect in every way. You can get your own pair of Hedas at Hedas.com and use the code Feisty20 for 20% off. That's Feisty20 at Hedas.com and it will all be in the show notes.
You know, you share a lot of your own vulnerable stories in the book, which is someone who also shares vulnerability. I really do appreciate. There was one that really stood out to me when you said to a colleague, a male colleague, you let estrogen get the best of you. Can you share that? I feel like this is so important because there's this double-edged sword conversation we're having about menopause, too, where we want to understand that the changing hormones can cause mood and anxiety, but we don't want to be defined as incapable. And we need, like, it's a hard line to walk. So I'd love you to share that a little bit.
Oh, you set that up so beautifully. So I've said this on more than one occasion. I gave an example from med school, probably because I was too embarrassed that as of a few years ago, I would still say that. I'm a deeply emotional person. I think that's probably what makes me a good doctor. I cry with my patients, but only until recently did I kind of accept that maybe that's not a bad thing to be human, hello, But when I was in med school, part of my training was at Mass General Hospital during my surgical training, where I think a piece of my soul is buried there and may never be resurrected. But in one of my very early experiences, there was a young woman who had a horrible, tragic accident. And she was in the intensive care unit. And I was really tending to her mom and talking to the mom. What could I do as a medical student? I couldn't fix her, but I could at least talk to the mother and be compassionate. And one of the residents saw me crying with the mother because she was just so distraught. Her daughter was going to die probably. And I was holding her hand and I was crying. And ultimately the resident saw me and said, you know, you really, I don't know that you're cut out to do this if you're going to cry with every patient. Now, of course, this was an extreme example of a mother about to lose her daughter. And I said, you're right. I probably let all my estrogen get the best of me. Like I was looking for some sort of default and excuse for being, I think, probably a really good medical student. And for years, I would have this kind of battle with patients. It's not like I'm crying with them all the time, but there are times when things are really sad or you've known
you're
someone
in oncology.
For many years. Yes. And only in recent years did I stop apologizing for sharing those human moments with patients, for letting them know how much I care about them, that they are not alone in their tears, that I love and adore so many of them, and to see them in pain causes a human reaction in me. But there were many, many times where I would say, you know, I have all this like estrogen, I'm so girly, but what the fuck? Why is that a problem? Why is that a problem? It shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah. I'm welling up just listening to you to talk about
yeah.
it. I'm not going to apologize for it. Like I think that should be standard. We're humans.
I remember there was a colleague of mine who inspired me to write this book, who tragically died in clinic at age 38 during COVID, not from COVID. And it was really a horrific, unexpected death. And when we had a Zoom almost memorial for him, because it was during the time of COVID, somebody had saw me crying and thought, well, maybe I would feel less embarrassed if I turned off the video. And I thought to myself, I understand that they were trying to be kind about maybe I might not want to show my vulnerability. But on the other hand, these were doctors, my colleagues. He was also a dear friend. And why are we kind of shunning an appropriate human response in that medical moment? And I thought, how often do we kind of shut down these human reactions in the doctor-patient space as well? Obviously, there's professionalism, but I think in the context of oncologic care, there are times where those lines of what it means to be a compassionate doctor can include showing emotion, and it doesn't mean we need to blame our estrogen or our femininity for that.
And that tees up perfectly what I really liked about, and I'd like to finish with, you talk about women apologizing for themselves. You actually begin the book with the story of a woman apologizing.
Yes.
One of your dying patients. And then you talk about you apologizing yourself. And I'd love for you to share a bit about that. And maybe let's end with, you know, how we can all move forward from all of what we've just talked about.
Yes. Well, I think you really nailed it there. I mean, if there's an Olympic sport in apologizing, I am the reigning gold champion. You could tell me it's raining outside and I'm guilty for it, and I'll be like, I'm so sorry. I am. You know what? I did control the weather that day. And I think, again, one of the things I've noticed in the practice really of what's, I think, a sacred space of caring for patients with cancer, is that even in the worst, most terrible diagnoses, and even when they are dying, there are women who are still apologizing for being sick or apologizing for normal human function, like sweating, like crying, like being in pain, not shaving your armpits. How many times do women go to the gynecologist and think, oh my God, I got to get waxed beforehand? Your gynecologist does not care. She probably didn't rush to her gynecologist before either. And if she did, she's part of the same legacy we've all inherited, where we are apologizing for our normal bodies. And at the end and at the conclusion of the book, what you're speaking about is I had my own medical journey when I had almost written the entire book about advocating for yourself. I have all these healthcare resources. And even still, in a moment of extreme pain, I doubted my own intuition about my diagnosis. I listened to some other doctor who really didn't know what they were talking about. And replace their thoughts with my own, you know, from my own intuition about what was wrong with me. And when it came to actually seeking care, was an apologetic, just a litany of apologies myself. I'm so sorry I didn't shower for 4 days because I couldn't, I physically couldn't, and I couldn't get myself out of bed. I'm so sorry that I'm here. I'm so sorry that I'm in pain. I'm so sorry to be bothering you. I have done it myself. And I think the tragedy for me in writing this book was realizing here I am devoting myself to empowering women, and I have done this myself. So where does that leave most women who do not have a medical degree, who may not know all this history that we've all kind of drank the Kool-Aid in and what's been baked into the system? And how can I possibly help women empower themselves to show up with what they need, honor that their medical care concerns are real and valid and deserve and are worthy of attention? And there's no world where they should be apologizing for that.
Amen. Words to live by. Well, thank you for writing this book. Thank you for your passion. Thank you for sharing and your vulnerability. It was definitely going to make a difference in people's lives.
I hope so. And I appreciate your helping to amplify our shared mission to strengthen and empower women in their best health.